Yeah.
Recording.
Yeah. All right. So we're starting. Okay. So, can everybody see this, orangish sort of?
Yep.
I really like the slide deck, by the way. I stole this from Google Slides. So, I have not come to tell you why everything you're doing is wrong or anything else, but I have come to try to explain through the, try to help people get through what is, I don't know if it's purposefully tough, but there's sort of a hype cycle. So you can think of this as a very similar to the hype cycle of the fact that we decided to call utility computing cloud computing. It's kind of in that vein. I think that I started out with a particular mindset on this, that it was like, you know, it was X, and then over basically, I don't know when Julian, I had promised this talk to Julian like 9 months ago. And then I watched like all of these YouTube talks and like took notes like this on like all these different things of all the different pieces. And then I tried to pull it together. And so I will dive into a little bit of code here and there. But this is more of a, how can you think about or getting through kind of the annoyance of the fact that this is a somewhat inscrutable set of terminology. And I think there is actually a slightly beneficial reason for why the term serverless is used and why it's not just functions as a service, but I'll give you that as my sort of teaser. When I started researching and writing this talk, I thought, it's just functions as a service. Why don't they just get over themselves? And there, I think there is something to it. So in the tech world, right, if you like, I forget who it was, but somebody said once, like, you know, listening to you guys talk, it's like, you know, like the names of technologies are like just insane sometimes, right? And the Discovery Environment team and I were like, we added to that like gleefully, at least for me. Like, so we had a hard time naming things. So I was just like, everything gets named after either a character or concept in Futurama, right? And we, you know, like that'll make things easy. And so that meant that we were talking about like just having people listen to us talk about the fact that Niblonian wasn't working when it was talking to Scruffy, and just made for like sort of, so like to a certain extent, I expect tech names to be kind of ludicrous and, you know, widget and kind of out there. But the branding for serverless, I think, is what makes it both, it's good for consultants, bad for people wanting to solve problems, get value, and get things done. So, I think the hype is actually potentially causing a little bit more damage necessarily than had intended. But the interesting thing here is that you're getting a convergence across the three major cloud providers in this notion of being able to provide a higher level abstraction beyond say giving you a raw virtual machine, or in the Atmosphere parlance, a raw instance. So this sort of, Lambda, I think, is almost 5 years old now, so it's a little bit longer than that. If you're playing in these spaces, Azure Functions are actually far enough along that people will often quickly mention them in the same sentence as Lambda, which is like kind of an interesting aspect, because I think most people would like to sort of like forget about Azure or like put them down in general, but the server offering from their perspective is it's kind of interesting. And then Google Cloud Functions, I think, are still in beta. Those of you who've been around Google for a while know that it'll probably be in beta maybe for the entirety of their product life. But they have actually done a few acquisitions to make that offering kind of come up to the industrial level for, or the industry's level for that offering. They've got I won't talk a lot about it, but they've got a compelling logging and remote testing a differentiator as a result of those acquisitions. But what we're looking at is a notion here for testing ideas. The way that I was pitching this when I gave it to the Python meetup was the idea that you might be able to put together a service idea for a startup or something along those lines to try to test value. What I would frame for us is the standpoint of, if I was a lab or I was trying to bring together collaborators, This is an easy way for me to test ideas. So if I have collaborators, say, in the TerraRef space that want to be doing machine learning on top of publicly available data sets, maybe this is a way for me to begin to do things to complement that. The other notion is just for a lay of the land perspective on like what you could think about these sort of things that are out in the industry and how they might play into programmable infrastructure or programmable cyber infrastructure. So, and we'll do a little bit of this, like what I'm calling backfilling. Like, so what I think is interesting about sort of testing these different things, and then try to give a little bit of strategy. So this is in general, not like at the lower level that you would get in some of the talks, but I think I'll be about at the same level of detail that you've seen in the last couple talks. So I'm going to test an idea. So again, the way I'll correspond this to this. So Phenome is in town. Let's say I meet some people at Phenome and I want to get together and I want to give the people at Phenome a place for them to chat, a place for me to be able to start to coalesce some information and then be able to do some extension of functionality. That would be one example, like science example. For me, I want to recruit vigilante dog catchers because I live in the unincorporated fire district of Drexel Heights and we have a stray dog problem. So you'll see that this notion of being able to, how would I organize and how would I communicate? And so one way for me to do that, I dropped this Bitly link here, is that I've put together very quickly with something called Zappa, a Slack inviter page that I can drop into an email. So that gives me a way for easy onboarding for the people that aren't interested. And I have a friend who's actually, he's a digital nomad living in Thailand, but his whole business is, in essence, I think that he just rebranded, I think it's called Slack Pass. But it's so for being able to, you're someone who's generating content and you want to provide Slack integrations. That's his startup. And one of the pain points is this idea that getting people invites or being able to grow a Slack channel is difficult. So this would provide me with the ability to give, this is a link. You can see that it's being served, or hopefully you can see this. It's being served off of the US East 1 availability zone for Amazon. And so this is just an example from Zappa.io. So it's called their Slack inviter. And in essence, that's this little bit right here. And so it gives you just like, it's an easy onboarding for, here's your email address, sign me up, okay? So this would be a way, again, organically, I have this like dog, I wanna recruit people for dog catching, I wanna get them into a Slack channel. This gives me that ability. Now, where you can kind of tag onto this interesting bit is you could use third-party tools for tracking your tracking visits and conversions on this, and you could do things like I did Zoom. I gave you a Bitly link, and so if you put a plus sign at the end of any Bitly short link, it'll give you the number of clicks and things, information. So. For those watching in the future, KiffShare was inspired by this view of Bitly, or the notion of share links from the discovery environment. Those share links was the idea that I could create a share link, a unique URL share link, and then I'd be able to get some amount of metrics off that link. So I think Nirav showed me this like first time. The whole, like, you just put the plus sign. So if you take the plus sign off, then it'll route you the way it's supposed to. So clever, those Bitly folks. But this would be just an example of that. And so again, I don't know if people are gonna come and help me protect my neighborhood and help get dogs so that they can find a forever home. So I don't wanna buy in to anything that I have to. So I, in essence, can use all of the sort of lower or free tier to test an idea and then figure that out.
ordinarily you would want to have, you'd be running a virtual machine or yeah. something that runs this website.
So like this is being served directly out of an S3 bucket. So it's something that, so here, I don't know if, hopefully I'm sharing everything, I think. So if you can't see, what you should be seeing now is my terminal. Yeah. Okay. So I'm sort of hopefully cheating up here, but this is an example of Lambda. You can see that I cheated and did a history. This is how I found my, and so if I say Zappa status, so this is as simple as you having AWS credentials on your system. And then pulling in the Zappa description, in this case, it was the Slack inviter. I made a few manipulations, and then I did a Zappa deploy. Pushed everything out. And then here you can see, this is the actual URL, or no, where is it? There. This is the actual URL. The nice thing about Zappa, too, is Zappa has the ability for you to have dev, staging, and production versions of things. So you can push things out and actually be testing against that. So you can find Zappa at, I think, zappa.io. It's a Python project. It's pretty interesting. So I won't go too far into the details, but but what I want to point out in the sort of portion here is, I said something and I don't know if it made total sense right away, but that page that I was showing you is being served out of S3. So S3 in essence is a serverless service. So that's where the notion from AWS's perspective that they're like, their point is that they're not like, they mean that, or serverless means something to them. And so they have messaging all around that, but it means things like there's no servers to provision or manage. It scales with usage. You never pay for idle. This is a delivery on the notion of utility computing. Again, cloud computing really was sort of an attempt to give you that utility computing. And then you can leverage the availability and fault tolerance of the actual provider that you're on. So it's a platform play. We can consider that part of the reason I think this is interesting to look at is Cyverse is an infrastructure platform. So the cyber infrastructure is a platform. What do those platform plays look like? Is there a platform play that could be helpful for something like this? The other interesting thing, although this is slightly probably controversial, I think the discovery environment is sort of like a serverless functions as a service environment. And I won't go too far into that. This sounds maybe a little, maybe Paul and maybe Aileen less right now, but I think that Paul, having worked on Tito was a way for you to do the integration. Once you've integrated that, you've abstracted away the actual execution. And so you've got this sort of execution environment or code execution environment. So the more appropriate definition of what I would say the discovery environment models from this is that it's become a code execution environment, or in other words, I've abstracted away the need for you to provision, install, and know how to install tools. And so that's one notion. The reason I mention it is if anybody digs into this and is crazy like me and gets up at 5 a.m. and watches serverless talks and GoTo conference talks. Simon Wardley talks about the code execution environment that he built back in like 2005, 2006 timeframe. And when he's talking about that code execution environment, it sounds an awful lot like the early versions and specs for what the discovery environment sort of inspiration was. So what the hell is serverless? I actually threw containerless in here because I thought it was funny. Containers probably are the only thing that will be like things I bust on and like I just, you know, apologize in advance. And then functions and service, like what is all this stuff? So one notion here is that I put it at the title, maybe the whole discipline, it's not really DevOps, but it's more ops dev. The portion here is that successful individuals for being able to leverage a platform like this are people that understand the operations, and as a result of understanding the operations, can leverage the services available in Azure or Google Cloud or in AWS. If you don't understand that, it's harder for you to deconstruct your offering to make available the services. So I don't remember my slides very well. So I'll just say this now, but there's sort of two companies that are of interest. or I should say that I can't remember his name, but I know he's the Claudia JS author. I have a slide in here that's one of his talks about estimating costs, and so we'll get to that. But and then A Cloud Guru, those two people are very, or those two examples as far as use cases are very interesting, just because of how far you can push this sort of notion. So A Cloud Guru is offering something akin to a MOOC, one of these massively open online courses, and they're doing it all in AWS, and their costs are like incredibly stupidly low. So this notion of operations savvy informs development to me is different. And so if you're going to be able to understand and apply these things, that's something to be noteworthy, at least to me. And people are kind of talking about it, but they're not saying it necessarily quite in that way. The other notion is that all of what we're talking about is challenging fixed ideas about how things should be done. So if you don't know this guy, his name is David Nolan. He's super, super smart. He ran a lot of the cool visualization things that you've seen at New York Times have come from David Nolan. He's an incredibly interesting guy. I would encourage you to take a look at this talk. I will provide these slides. But my thing that I loved is it. He said, when you go to conferences, we're really trying to talk about, this is the crap we do, and we think it's pretty cool. So in other words, that whatever we're doing today is pretty malleable. We think it's the best thing we can. We mean well. We want to be happy, but it may not age over time. And so there really are no right answers. And I think that every time we have a new technology that, and serverless and function services is obviously falls prey to this, we have this idea that they're, you know, it's going to solve everything. And then we find out, well, it solves some things. But another way of looking at this is we're exchanging problems for problems, right? So every time we put together a solution, that solution is going to generate some set of problems. What are those problems? That's the thing we really want to talk about. So this, a lot of my viewpoint for this is everything you're seeing in the serverless and functions as a service world is sort of coming out of this way of providing a generalized backend as a service. Mobile applications drove this. So mobile applications needed to have some way of being able to store things, some way of being able to handle doing push messaging, all these other different pieces. And that really kind of pushed this in this backend as a service. So this is one way of thinking of, you know, like a generalized voting system. I don't have if people are interested, I think this is called CloudCroft. It's cloudcroft.co is where you can get these little cool pictures. I think they're awesome. I'm very fond of them. I'm not sure the right term here, but this is like that sort of like three quarter, is it isomorphic? Okay. That three quarter view is just like, I don't know. It's like super nice. Okay. So we have a person, they have a mobile device. They want to do voting. That's what we see here. All right. And they've decided to use these sort of like two towers style Lord of the Rings passing through a gateway. And so serverless options that you have, and again, this is the notion of why it's serverless, right? So I can serve information from Route 53. I can serve a whole website that's a static website out of S3. If you're in the JavaScript space and you're okay with the fact that, like, you know, curly bracket plus curly bracket is something you've never written in your life as a JavaScript developer, then you're probably okay with this. Actually, hold on one second. I think we just got a message from my mom included in the thing. So there we go. All right, so knowing my mom, she's going to, yeah, hi, Mom. Knowing my mom, and happy birthday to my brother, who's old. but we can serve things out of S3 in their static sites. And if I say that to a normal person, they're like, who cares? And I'm like, if you only knew how hot and sexy statically generated sites are. So like Gatsby and all these other sort of applications are all about generating static sites and then serving those static sites out. In fact, Risky Business, the Risky Business podcast, risky.biz, is 100% statically generated and pushed out because you don't have to have JavaScript. And so in essence, it's considered to be a very nice and secure way of handling this. So this pattern is something that's far more interesting than people may realize. And it's partly driven in some cases by the fact that you can have static sites and a single page JavaScript application merged together and then serve them out. So it's pretty handy. Beyond that, it's these sort of services that are available to you in the Amazon offering. So I can have this gateway. That gateway can handle doing authentication for me. That gateway can handle doing various different bits. And I can identify that this person who's coming to my voting application is not the same person who just voted, at the very least. I may be able to actually figure out who they are with their Google OAuth or their Facebook or whatever the heck Facebook's calling identity now. I can route that to a Lambda function. And here, if you're not familiar, this is just like the idea of Lambda calculus. Lambda calculus came up in the Elm talk, right? These are anonymous functions for the most part, right? And so that's where the name kind of comes from. I can execute that, and I write that record out to something like DynamoDB. That triggers another Lambda function in this architecture that actually goes ahead and updates the information that's available here in the S3 bucket. So this is just a sort of, this is one of the, I think this is one of their, like, they're considered use case examples, and they're all rendered in this cool thing. So my Drexel Heights dog catchers, it looks in essence like this. So I have a user, they visit this page, it's been served out of here through this bucket that I stored through Zappa. Zappa did that for me. They're routing through here and they come back and they're actually going to the Amazon gateway to go to that page and then be actually sent out to Slack. And so the icon there for Slack. And so there's the, if people wanted the, there I'm actually doing the appropriate branding for these people. The interesting thing, although I didn't use this, is you can play around with these different architectures and you can start to tweak it and say, I want to cache at the API gateway. And I want to do like some of these different pieces. I want to actually size out, where these different pieces are running. And it'll start to give you cost estimates. Like it actually pulls in the information from Amazon and it'll do cost estimates for you based on sort of these different pieces. So this kind of gives you a notion of if you're an ops savvy person and you're buying into my crazy idea that operations savvy leads to development success in this ops dev world that doesn't really exist, but I should trademark. You can start to figure out how well you're doing on your cost estimates as you start to adopt different pieces. The other thing that's a little bit weird, and I'll mention this in passing, is that we don't normally as developers like the idea that we're going to talk directly to a service. And that's considered to be one of these things that you have to sort of like, it's the how I learned to love the bomb. What's the Dr. Strangelove? That by calling service, some of the services directly, as a result, you're able to leverage more of the Amazon's portfolio overall. And so you'll see that that means you're tightly coupling, but you're tightly coupling for the benefit of a lot of cost savings. So again, this is just what Amazon means by that. So the two examples to me that are the best for the person, the counter example, right? Someone's like, well, why do they call it serverless? And it's API Gateway and S3 are two examples of you being able to get functionality without provisioning and managing that. Therefore, that's a serverless offering. So the people that are very coy from Amazon are like, whenever S3 came out, which was like 2000, I think, or 2001, they're like, that was our first serverless offering. So first to market, whatever. But the notion here is you're never paying for idleness. So this, I think, is something that's very appealing to folks when you're looking at scientific workflows and things along those lines. So what this also does mean, although I'm not going to say a whole lot about this, is that your finding is that that why people are coming to these different platforms has a lot to do with data. So I can't talk a lot about it intelligently, but I want to give a plug to Blake because Blake is going to be talking about machine learning. And so for machine learning, I usually need data sets to be able to train something. So I need to be able to have labeled data sets that'll tell me like, these are positive words and these are negative words. And if I have that information, I can do something like sentiment analysis or something along those lines. So part of the reason you'd be drawn to the Google Cloud is that they have those data sets made available to you and they have made them available to you in a robust way. So when you talk about data science and data scientists, There's the, I'm a math person and I know what linear regression is and I know all the different math bits. And there's also, I'm a software engineer who knows how to make make data available to data intensive applications in a highly available, robust manner. And they're often used and put under the same umbrella, which is sort of usually an identification of something that's at the nascent stages of being identified. But so what might draw someone to Amazon or to Google or whatever might be the actual data that's been made available to the cloud. So another way of framing that also in a Cyverse perspective is Cyverse has a large data store, trying to be able to make sure that you can bring your data in and then make it available within the substrate of that platform. Again, same sort of platform play. All right. So I think that it's worth sort of talking about this notion of intention or intentionality just in the, what are they trying to solve? And what they're trying to solve in essence is abstracting away from you the need to have to know about a server and actually have to know about a container. So you can think about, there's a Lynn Langit is one of the speakers that I watched in preparation for this. She did a talk called Serverless Reality or BS. She also did a couple talks related to cancer genomics and cancer workflows in relation to AWS and serverless. So if you're interested, I'd check those out. But her argument was that the sort of intention of, or I'm framing her comments as the intention of serverless is really to abstract away a lot of these bits of information that would normally be considered sort of ancillary or like the cost of doing business. Like I have to know about this server. I have to know when I update this server. I have to know that this server is an X so that I can patch it with whatever the latest vulnerability related to the CPU pipelining and ghosts with branches that will whack you is. I have to know about that stuff. So I think that if you're willing to imagine positive intent in the realm of serverless and functions as a service, the intention is, in essence, to say, we think containers and container orchestration and all of these sort of different bits are a distraction. We want to amplify what you're doing, the work you're doing. And they're going all the way down to the definition of functions. Functions are where your value add is to a platform like this. Okay, so how does any of this stuff work? In the essence, you define a function. It can be Python if you're like me, you like Python. You're like, hey, Python, it's cool. And so I have to have something that knows that an event happened and then calls me. So I went back to one of my old colleagues from my Archon Technologies days, and I swear that BizTalk server had something like this sort of things would happen, and then you would wake workers, and the workers would do work until the queue met a certain level, and then they'd go back to sleep. But in essence, you have to have a system that allows you to do some level of eventing. So what that means then is we have an event source. That event source will then be triggering functions. Those functions will be calling out to services. And again, this comes back to this notion that I have to talk to Amazon services. Now, the thing that everybody wants to do when they start looking at this is they want like the meta lingua franca of libraries that will talk to every possible cloud so that you don't have to deal with this idea that you're binding yourself, you're attaching, you're fusing yourself tightly coupled at the hip with, say, cloud functions if you're going to Google Cloud or Azure functions or Lambda. The reality is most of the work you have to do is somewhere between 400 and 800, maybe 900 lines of code. And so if you had to throw it away, it's not a giant investment. So there's this notion to steal from the notion of Elm. Elm files are longer. It's just a natural notion of the fact that you have a compiler and strong types. So there's a convention in JavaScript that you make your files short. You want the files to be shorter because you don't want there to be any leakage outside that file if possible, right? And let's not talk about modules and everything else. But in essence, you have these sort of things that sort of grow up in the context of where you're at, right? And so the interesting thing is you see now in different technologies, people decide they're going to talk about, hey, when you're coming from the place that you were to this new place, here are the things that you need to either question or consider as you're doing things. And so one of those notions when you're moving into a serverless or functions as a service paradigm is the fact that what you're writing is actually much, much smaller. So the serverless, there's not just to confuse the heck out of everybody. There is a framework called serverless, which whenever you see it, it'll have serverless and it'll have like a trademark at the end, right? So like serverless, like trademark, patent pending. And they have said, relatively interesting, that a lot of their customers come to them thinking that they are this magic Pentecost of libraries that can talk to all the clouds. So the interesting thing, if you start to look at what's going on here, you have different guarantees for the Azure queuing than you do for AWS Simple Queuing Service. And so even if you could like absorb what they call their methods, because you know we're programmers, everything has to have a unique, interesting name. So you know it's create without the E if you're a kernel developer. You have guarantees of the calling context or what the semantics are of how that's executed are likely to vary between the clouds. So it doesn't really benefit you. So that would be my only like sort of soapbox on that. What can you do? Well, at least this varies from cloud provider to cloud provider, but the functions are often being written in either JavaScript or Python you see most frequently. Now, AWS being a place where a lot of Java development is done, you see that AWS does support Java. And then C# is a first class citizen for Azure functions. One of the things that's not on this slide, but Go is also mentioned as being one of these. I think Go is remarkably interesting in that with a Go build cycle, it's very natural for you to take all of your dependencies and bundle them into one giant executable. And so a Go developer is more likely to be used to that than say a JavaScript or Python developer. I've done most of my playing around with Python, but I would say in the JavaScript space, the thing that's most interesting to me is the fact that with NPM you have shrink wrap, and shrink wrap would allow you to be able to pull everything together and then ship that as dependencies. I can tell you from direct experience in the last 48 hours, Python with C dependencies is not necessarily, it is non-trivial. Maybe is the nicest way for me to put that. But if you've been a Python developer for some time, you have run into this probably at some point, so you may be better at this than me.
I have a question.
Oh. Yeah.
So why are there a small number of supported programming languages? I guess I had this, I'm imagining that they give you some kind of execution environment where you can run whatever kind of executable you want, and it just takes input and spits out output. Is it that
you'd have to ask the program or the product managers for AWS Lambda and that? Like, these are the languages that they've selected. I have no in understanding of why they've selected them.
Okay, I guess what I'm asking is, are there language specific aspects of the service that prevent them from just letting you run whatever you want that you know of?
Not that I like. I don't have the deep understanding here. I think it has to do with what runtime environments they've made available. So you can think about at this point, you really can't sort of jettison the notion of containers from having to understand that. If you've got some experience with containers, I think it's helpful. But the notion here is that what they're supporting is execution environments in these four languages. And then I think Go for AWS is either in beta or they announced that it's released like sometime in November. So these are the ones that they're optimizing for. And so their tooling in AWS is supporting these languages. Why that is, I don't know. But in essence, you're building out, if you're going to do your Python, in the case of Python, you have to build all of your dependencies against the Amazon Linux environment. That's the targeted environment that you're going to run in. So when you're building out your function, if your function is really simple and like it uses like Boto, then you'll have a lot of that stuff made available to you. So they're making some assumptions with that. So I don't know if they're guiding you to this or if they've done market research and these are your top 10 languages. These are five of the top 10 languages or Jeff Bezos thinks that Node is amazing and wants to support that just to make, you know, I have no idea. So, and that's Thank not you. An answer to your question really, other than, I don't know.
That's fine.
So I've already kind of talked about this utility bit. Just in the notion, Gotchko, that's his name. Gotchko, I believe that would be Adzic. The IC is pronounced like an ICH. And he's the Claudia JS author. And so again, Node.js are popular targets for this. The serverless framework trademarked is, I believe, all in Node.js. Part of the reason I've been using Zappa was because Zappa is Python related. AWS has a nice language nice environment library called Chalice that I have done a little bit with and will show at the end. There was a question on the last talk, like how would I convince my manager that this was interesting, right? So in a university environment, this is sort of twofold. One is we do have an AWS rep, I believe, and there is some encouragement for doing some of the things in that environment. But the notion here would be if you had a cost model, or if you had a always on server and you were able to look at what would it cost. So if you're hosting as a lab and you have hosting in whatever your favorite hosting environment is, this paper would give you some notion of the different sort of aspects of looking at that from an economic perspective. And then A Cloud Guru, which is the letter A cloud and then dot guru. They've got a number of things about sort of speccing the cost savings related to this. And that it really, like right now, a lot of this is being drawn in the cost model. So it does feel an awful lot to me like a loss leader to some extent from the supermarket model, to borrow from that, that in essence, the cloud providers want to get you to bring your data into the system, and the functions of the service and serverless and different services available to you are in essence to help make it worth your while once your data is there. So that's a personal statement from what I've seen so far. I think it makes somewhat sense, but I can't prove the math. Okay, so hype versus reality. Again, this borrows from, I'm gonna borrow from Lynn Langit's talk. I found this morning from the Daily Stoic, which is Ryan Holiday's newsletter, but I thought it was super, super interesting here. So in essence, I think there is a benefit to cultivating a taste for some of what might be distasteful regarding serverless. And the other notion is that I may be having to go directly to a service and I don't like that idea, but that is I think some benefit here. So I stole this quote and dropped it in this morning. You don't know Ambrose Bierce, he's a Civil War general, I believe. So the hype, costs are cheap, coding is easy. I can tell you right now, coding is not easy. It is and it isn't. Configuration is a breeze, no, kind of. Transparent error reporting, totally not true. It's great for developers, maybe, I'm not totally sold. Lynn Langit makes this comment that monitoring is a totally unsolved problem for DevOps. I don't have enough experience to know that, but that was her statement as a consultant. Deployment is simple. It can be. I can show you the Zappa example. That is like Zappa's makes it very simple. But it is definitely not best for everything. So you can kind of see what are the realities of these things. The costs are cheap right now. The interesting thing, though, for that is that this is somewhat of a moving target. So I think you get some ungodly amount of executions in Lambda for free, and then it resets every month.
A million.
Yeah, is it a million? Okay. I think that there's definitely a desire to try to get people to dip their toe and try this out. And I think there are some ways for it to be beneficial. Yes?
I was just going to say, I've seen some cells that are like, if you have like a microservice environment that's at scale, then you only scale the surface that's getting hit the hardest.
Yep.
So you save a lot there. But
yeah, I mean, it requires a level of operation savvy. So I think that the, you know, people that have gotten tired of pick your favorite large company X, and they have like SRE experience, like site reliability engineering experience, I would imagine that they'd be able to put together a very cost-effective way to test ideas. So you're able to you know, like it does, another way to put that is some of this presupposes that you have gone through the steps of breaking up your monolithic client-server application into microservices. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about that.
But exactly, which is more tied to microservices than serverless anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So, and there are people also that think that, like, this is microservices. Like, they haven't been exposed to microservices until now, and so their reality is combining the two.
Right.
And so, so it's interesting, right? Like, coding is easy. I've actually seen some people give talks where they think the coding and configuration is different enough from traditional development that they're trying to hire grads out of school to like, that are clean slates. They're like tabula rasa. Like they're completely clean slates and they want to have the opportunity to poison them with this approach or the view of the world. Poison, if you're on the right.
Indoctrinate.
Affect. Yes. Not poison. But so that is one thought as far as like staffing. So I think that, so one of the nice things is that coding can be easy because you really are working at like the unit of a function. And so you can mock things out and you're able to execute in a local environment if necessary. So there, the amount of information that you have to sort of store in your head, ideally you're trying to make small. So that can be nice. Now the configuration is a breeze. Part of the reason why I make this like maybe, I had hideous time trying to figure out what permissions were necessary for me to do various things in just the little bits that I was doing. So that can be trouble. And then in preparation for some things, I've been trying to get this Lambda implementation of Let's Encrypt that uses DNS challenges for generating certificates. And the configuration was actually all done through CloudFormation, which apparently is really nice, but I can't get it actually to call the function now. Like the function's dependencies are now not building in the way that I need. So the configuration was like, here's CloudFormation, the ability for me to throw a template up, and that template generated all the different permissions and roles and policy stuff that was necessary once I figured out that you couldn't ask for CloudFormation, the ability to create CloudFormation through the UI, you had to do it from a custom JSON template. Thanks Stack Overflow. Yes, I'm almost done. Configuration, not a breeze. The error reporting is in the environment I'll show you with the limited time I have left. I don't know that it's great for all developers or great for developers. I can say that I don't think that monitoring is quite there yet, although there do seem to be some startups that are coming in to try to fill that gap. And then deployment can be simple. It's definitely not best for everything. So who would succeed with this? I think that if you've gone through the process and you know the landscape enough to be able to have broken your system into microservices, another way of looking at this is you've separated your read and write paths from your application. That's what CQRS really means, is that you're optimizing the read path of your application. How does information get fetched? And you're optimizing the operation of your write path. How does data come into the system? That's really what CQRS is about. A convenient and good way to do that is through event sourcing or adopting an event-driven approach. You could do that with event-driven architecture or with SATA. Those are all other ways of doing that. If you've got a system where you're using not only SQL, you've got other different tuned data persistence, and to do all of those things, you probably did all that to get to microservices. So if you don't have microservices, this could be a large leap. So if you're looking at things, you know, if you have microservices, your discovery environment team has microservices. So that would be one of these sort of notions. There is something called Kubeless that Julian told me about, and that is the ability for you to run serverless architectures on Kubernetes. So if you don't know about that, sounds like it's pretty cool. And that's where we're at. I've got, according to my clock, 6 minutes. So, and then, like always, I've planned to talk the entire time and not really answer questions. So if you went to my landing page and signed up for the Drexel Heights Dog Catchers, you were probably welcomed by my dog, Billy. Billy would tell you hello. And so Billy is my bot, and Billy will welcome everyone to the application or to the chat rooms. And then one of the things that's missing from if you were a HipChat user, one of the things that's missing in the Slack world is the ability to do table flips. So I find that I want to flip tables very often, especially when I'm doing various software development things. And so this is another example, and we'll quickly kind of like look at these two examples. Let's see. Where did I put them? That's not it. Although I got a free pastry coming to me. That's not it. Although everything you learned about Elm is totally useless. You should all be doing Reason. I don't know where my, okay, let's just see if my Lambda, okay, this is, so if you are a sadistic individual, you can do all of this from the actual AWS console. And
you
so,
masochistic.
You
did sadistic, but both.
Okay, both, yeah, yeah, if you hate yourself, if you're like me and you hate yourself, you could do it this way. I talked about events and I kind of glossed over that. This is a function that is handling the bot event. So anytime anyone mentions Billy in that Slack channel, that generates a bot event in the AWS world. That bot event is then handled here by Lambda. This is the Lambda. And then it is handling calls through the API gateway and then to the CloudWatch logs. So really quick, now I have to get rid of that token because I am being recorded, but it's not being posted immediately, so I can go ahead and invalidate that. So here. This makes more sense to Python developers, and since I was doing this for a Python hangout or Python meetup, so I have a file that's a Python that is this Lambda function, and I have a function called Lambda handler, and so that's what in essence is being called. So this is my entry point. This is the equivalent of main, as far as you're considered. So if you're old school Python developer where you like wrote like Python one-off Python scripts, you too can use AWS Lambda. In essence, there are a couple different pieces, but I have some data, I have some context, and then I go ahead and step through this. So I return this, I am a teapot, just because I like HTTP jokes. So anything I don't understand, then I go ahead and say that I'm a teapot, even though this is not a teapot. And I use the thing that was the hardest about this was that I didn't know how to use, I couldn't, at the time I wrote this, I didn't know how to package Python dependencies. So what is that? It's that computer? Okay. Sorry, I was like, that's not on my machine. I had to actually do URL 2, and I'm using Python 2.7 because deal with it. Python 2.7 is available by default, and then you can pick that. But I was just dealing with here's your runtime. This is a bit of the question. So Chris asked a question about runtime, so you can see these are the runtime execution environments that have been made available. I have no idea why they chose these. But in essence, your work is in a short like short sort of function. So from the standpoint of being able to run this and test this, you have to be able to mock out the different dependencies and then be able to run it locally and then be able to deploy it. The missing part, and I'm going to do the same thing that infuriated me yesterday, is I'm not talking about how to package dependencies. A lot of people who talk about this stuff will go, and dependencies are left as an exercise to the reader. And I, being the reader yesterday, was like, no! So I'm in the middle of trying to use some nice work done by local Python developers on topics like PEX to be able to Ruby. I don't know why.
Ruby.
Okay. So he had given a nice talk on that. So that's a thing that I'm looking at. So with the time I don't have anymore, really quickly, let's look at the table flip function that I just showed you. So table flipless. So one of the cool, so one of the cool things that Amazon has done is this Chalice library. So if you're going to start out, you're like, wow, that was so cool. That's so amazing. Now that I know everything I need to know about statically typed functional languages, I'm going to go dominate the world with serverless. And you can do that with Chalice. So it looks remarkably like Flask or Bottle or whatever your favorite small micro framework is. And you can go ahead and throw together the handling of routes, and you can see that this is everything for that flipping, the table flip is just right here. And the nice thing about this is that for me, I've purposely picked something that's remarkably small. So like I have no dependencies to deal with. And then this is when, wherever that was, whenever this command is actually put into to chat, that will become an event and my Lambda is called. So if people want to ask questions and hang around, I will hang around for another 5-10 minutes. But thank you for your time and attention.
So science workflows are pretty bursty.
Yeah.
Would this be a good match for?
Oh, you know what? So every time I do this, I like realize that I didn't talk about the one thing that I should have talked about. So what I didn't talk about was okay, this was a comment a fair bit of, but yeah. So the HPS, part of the reason you use the gateway is HPS. So and you can get. Let's encrypt certs to put at HP for the gateway for that. So science workflows. Part of the thing that's interesting, and this has to do more with there's a constraint put on functions as a service execution. In most environments, will only let you do 5 minutes. And so part of this is because my understanding is to avoid like overconsumption or thundering herd is what's usually mentioned from the people is why they, because this can, so Theron had mentioned one of the patterns that architects will do with this is that they'll take their service that they consider to be the one that's most likely to require handling as a result of bursts in traffic, and they'll make that part of their Lambda. There's no way to understand what the next big app is on whatever social media. And so they don't know when they could handle that. Another notion is, although I don't know how entirely true this is, if this is just like anecdotal or like a post hoc rationalization, is that they also claim that part of the reason they do that is to protect you against yourself. In other words, that you could end up in sort of this infinite loop. And then you could end up kind of like going off into the ether and pay for that execution. So they're like, they have to have some bounds. So, but there's it's 5 minutes on Azure for sure. I believe it's 5 minutes. It was 5 minutes on AWS and they may have just changed it. The other notion for some of this is that there are talks, if you're interested in the AWS targeting, there are talks called like tuning Lambda or like the masterclass on Lambda or black belt, becoming a AWS Lambda black belt, and they will talk about more of the nuts and bolts, lower level details. A fair bit of it seems to be your ability to create experiments and then test what the memory consumption does for you. So you can ask for more or less memory. By default, I think you get something small like 128 megabytes.
So that, that time limit on the function execution is arbitrary though.
Yes.
Based on the provider. So if you use something like Kubeless.
Kubeless would be, so from a Cybers perspective, the fact that it is limited in the public cloud is a benefit.
Yep.
And I will say nothing more on that because I'm venturing into wild strategic speculation. But I mean,
from a strategy point of
view. But from a strategy point of view, in my perspective, speaking as Andrew Leonard, it's not as someone related to Cybers, I would see that as being a differentiator and benefit. But Kubeless, or it would be another way of framing it would be it's a reason to look at IBM OpenWhisk or Kubeless and Kubernetes, because now you have the ability to provide that to a community that you know has workflows that are not likely to fit into a public cloud offering. So that, you know, and then from beyond that, you know, this is also an area that from a workflow and execution planning perspective, you have to leverage from communities like the HPC and HTC, the high throughput computing and high performance computing world. They likely have a lot of input into this, and I just am not savvy enough.
Well, actually, you mentioned something earlier about that users, the public clouds use functions as a service as a loss leader to get your data in their cloud.
Yeah.
If we have a data store, right?
Yeah.
So that potentially is another.
I mean, the data store and IRODs have provided a way for you to be able to get data into a location robustly. So, but I mean, so that execution constraint, I think, is one way for you to deal with creativity. So I think there are patterns, at least in the Azure functions, where the libraries will actually do things like they'll do as much work as they can. And if they're not done, they'll like generate another event. And then they'll come back and finish where they left off. So I don't know that it's fair to call it this, but it's kind of like a high watermark in a Kafka queue. So like I'm going to, you know, my worker's going to go to sleep and then I'm going to wake up and come and pick up where I left off. And so you'll see people are doing patterns, different patterns like that. Patterns are emerging in the functions as a service community. And I don't know them all. I'm still a noob.
Yeah. We had a researcher who was trying to do cancer imaging using functions as a service and seeing if we could use Cybers infrastructure for that. It turned out that so that might still be
I don't know. Is that a fair answer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Maybe kind of related. So in the hype list and the point two is talking about coding is easy or something, right? Apparently because you have to make your functions small to make them run fast in under 5 minutes, right?
Yes.
But if you're doing that, does not mean that you're moving all your coding, your coordination and logic from the server instead of the client? And now the client has to manage all the coordination between the functions?
I think that the question was about what, so I don't know if everyone can hear you further away, but I'll repeat just on premise for good speaker karma. In making your coding smaller and having to deal with coordination, or as a result of that, are you moving the coordination into your functions? And so,
moving it from your server function
from your server function into the client. I don't know. I think there's a possibility you could do that. You could end up having that. Like I haven't seen enough sort of. So the part that's interesting to me for this is that I haven't delved into sample architectures to see what are the do's and don'ts. But I think you could end up in that. I think part of it is you're trying to avoid some of the coordination bits. And so I think that you're trying to make your work, the work that you're doing in these like relatively small. And so I think if the unit of work is small enough to avoid the execution timing, execution constraint, then you don't have to worry about coordination as much. But yeah, I think that, I don't know, there's a possibility. The A Cloud Guru and then Gachko's, the Claudia.js guy, they're very interesting because they've got the real world experience that I don't have to tell you about. So
I was posted a link in the UA campus about a paper written in the last year about scientific workflows using serverless type architectures. It looks like people are starting to think about it in that direction.
I mean, I think there's a lot of fertile ideas for things that you want to be able to periodically build. So like alignments for, or building actual genomes or models that you want to do machine learning against, these sort of periodic tasks. Like, I think there's a lot of fertileness in that regard, but I don't know if those workflows can handle the bounds that are applied. So it's a little bit different, but, and I don't, that's a space I don't know a whole lot about, right? But the folks in Pegasus have done a lot of stuff with that. Yep. And then high throughput computing, I think, is all about that. Darren, you had a question?
Oh, maybe. I just saw, and I don't know if this is like Future Hive of like future of where it's going or if this is where it's at, that was selling this idea that because their functions, then like the machine learning algorithms can like predict the load on a function. And so if your architecture was like a bunch of functions, you would only like auto scale like the function that was requiring the most work.
Me.
That like just totally like in a world where
that's somebody who's smarter than me. I think it's possible to
like there was a service or whatever that would automatically for you because of like the AWS machine.
I don't know.
Like you can, balancers or whatever.
If you'd instrumented your service or your entire system, there's a possibility that you'd be able to figure out where the bottlenecks are. Maybe is what they're talking about. But
there's no like machine learning. Like,
yeah, I'd have to know something about machine learning.
Yeah.
So sure.
It sounds like this makes it.
It just sounds like something you would
go
set
ahead,
up yourself. It's not a service. It's something you would set up yourself. It's not like
thing. Theron, it sounds like this absolves you from having to care about how to scale your functions, because from the developer's perspective, you can run a function 10 times or a million times, and you know it's like a pay as you go sort of thing. So it sounds like this makes it so you don't have to care about, you know, one of your functions all of a sudden runs much more frequently.
Well, that's what I meant. So they have their own machine learning that auto scales that service.
But you have to think about, like, you have to have been capturing the execution of your system, and then use that as an input into your predictive modeling. So I don't like if that is a thing, I don't know anything about it.
Okay.
But I don't know enough about it. The interesting corollary of what you're talking about is if you are a software architect, how do you use this? Right? That's sort of where I came to from this. And what I realized was, and that's why I called the talk what I called it, is that your average software architect might not have enough operational experience to leverage this to the full capacity. So,
all right. I'm going to stop the recording, but if you want to chat with Andy after this. But thank you very much for giving us this lovely introduction to serverless functions. And,
thank you, Leonard.
Post it all afterwards, the video as well as the slides. Thank you very much.